Those are characteristics of knowledge, and they explain why I use the term. But it is strange usage, for one other characteristic is missing. We have no direct access to what it is we know, no rules or generalizations with which to express this knowledge. Rules, which could supply that access, would refer to stimuli, not sensations. And stimuli we can know only through elaborate theory. In its absence, the knowledge embedded in the stimulus-to-sensation route remains tacit. Though it is obviously preliminary, and need not be correct in all details, what has just been said about sensation is meant literally. At the very least, it is a hypothesis about vision, which should be subject to experimental investigation, though probably not to direct check. But talk like this of seeing and sensation here also serves metaphorical functions, as it does in the body of the book. We do not see electrons, but rather their tracks, or else bubbles of vapor in a cloud chamber. We do not see electric currents at all, but rather the needle of an ammeter or galvanometer. Yet in the preceding pages, particularly in section 10, I have repeatedly acted as though we did perceive theoretical entities like currents, electrons, and fields, as though we learned to do so from examination of exemplars, and as though in these cases, too, it would be wrong to replace talk of seeing with talk of criteria and interpretation. The metaphor that transfers seeing to contexts like these is scarcely a sufficient basis for such claims. In the long run, it will need to be eliminated in favor of a more literal mode of discourse. The computer program referred to above begins to suggest ways in which that may be done, but neither available space nor the extent of my present understanding permits my eliminating the metaphor here. Instead, I shall try briefly to bulwark it. Seeing water droplets or a needle against a numerical scale is a primitive perceptual experience for the man unacquainted with cloud chambers and ammeters. It thus requires contemplation, analysis, and interpretation, or else the intervention of external authority, before conclusions can be reached about electrons or currents. But the position of the man who has learned about these instruments and had much exemplary experience with them is very different. And there are corresponding differences in the way he processes the stimuli that reach him from them. Regarding the vapor in his breath on a cold winter afternoon, his sensation may be the same as that of a layman, but viewing a cloud chamber, he sees, here literally, not droplets, but the tracks of electrons, alpha particles, and so on. Those tracks are, if you will, criteria that he interprets as indices of the presence of the corresponding particles, but that route is both shorter and different from the one taken by the man who interprets droplets. Or consider the scientist inspecting an ammeter to determine the number against which the needle has settled. His sensation probably is the same as the layman's, particularly if the latter has read other sorts of meters before. But he has seen the meter, again often literally, in the context of the entire circuit, and he knows something about its internal structure. For him, the needle's position is a criterion, but only of the value of the current. To interpret it, he need determine only on which scale the meter is to be read. For the layman, on the other hand, the needle's position is not a criterion of anything except itself. To interpret it, he must examine the whole layout of wires, internal and external, experiment with batteries and magnets, and so on. In the metaphorical, no less than in the literal use of seeing, interpretation begins where perception ends. The two processes are not the same, and what perception leaves for interpretation to complete depends drastically on the nature and amount of prior experience and training. 5. Exemplars, incommensurability, and revolutions. What has just been said provides a basis for clarifying one more aspect of the book, my remarks on incommensurability and its consequences for scientists debating the choice between successive theories. In sections 10 and 12, I have argued that the parties to such debates inevitably see differently certain of the experimental or observational situations to which both have recourse. Since the vocabularies in which they discuss such situations consist, however, predominantly of the same terms, they must be attaching some of those terms to nature differently, and their communication is inevitably only partial. As a result, the superiority of one theory to another is something that cannot be proved in the debate. Instead, I have insisted, each party must try, by persuasion, to convert the other. Only philosophers have seriously misconstrued the intent of these parts of my argument. A number of them, however, have reported that I believe the following. The proponents of incommensurable theories cannot communicate with each other at all. As a result, in a debate over theory choice, there can be no recourse to good reasons. Instead, theory must be chosen for reasons that are ultimately personal and subjective. Some sort of mystical apperception is responsible for the decision actually reached. More than any other parts of the book, the passages on which these misconstructions rest have been responsible for charges of irrationality. Consider first my remarks on proof. The point I have been trying to make is a simple one, long familiar in philosophy of science. Debates over theory choice cannot be cast in a form that fully resembles logical or mathematical proof. In the latter, premises and rules of inference are stipulated from the start. If there is disagreement about conclusions, the parties to the ensuing debate can retrace their steps one by one, checking each against prior stipulation. At the end of that process, one or the other must concede that he has made a mistake, violated a previously accepted rule. After that concession, he has no recourse, and his opponent's proof is then compelling. Only if the two discover, instead, that they differ about the meaning or application of stipulated rules, that their prior agreement provides no sufficient basis for proof, does the debate continue, in the form it inevitably takes during scientific revolutions. That debate is about premises, and its recourse is to persuasion as a prelude to the possibility of proof. Nothing about that relatively familiar thesis implies either that there are no good reasons for being persuaded, or that those reasons are not ultimately decisive for the group. Nor does it even imply that the reasons for choice are different from those usually listed by philosophers of science: accuracy, simplicity, fruitfulness, and the like. What it should suggest, however, is that such reasons function as values, and that they can thus be differently applied, individually and collectively, by men who concur in honoring them. If two men disagree, for example, about the relative fruitfulness of their theories, or if they agree about that but disagree about the relative importance of fruitfulness and, say, scope in reaching a choice, neither can be convicted of a mistake. Nor is either being unscientific. There is no neutral algorithm for theory choice, no systematic decision procedure which, properly applied, must lead each individual in the group to the same decision. In this sense, it is the community of specialists, rather than its individual members, that makes the effective decision. To understand why science develops as it does, one need not unravel the details of biography and personality that lead each individual to a particular choice, though that topic has vast fascination. What one must understand, however, is the manner in which a particular set of shared values interacts with the particular experiences shared by a community of specialists, to ensure that most members of the group will ultimately find one set of arguments, rather than another, decisive. That process is persuasion. But it presents a deeper problem. Two men who perceive the same situation differently, but nevertheless employ the same vocabulary in its discussion, must be using words differently. They speak, that is, from what I have called incommensurable viewpoints. How can they even hope to talk together, much less to be persuasive? Even a preliminary answer to that question demands further specification of the nature of the difficulty. I suppose that, at least in part, it takes the following form. The practice of normal science depends on the ability, acquired from exemplars, to group objects and situations into similarity sets, which are primitive, in the sense that the grouping is done without an answer to the question, similar with respect to what? One central aspect of any revolution is, then, that some of the similarity relations change. Objects that were grouped in the same set before are grouped in different ones afterward, and vice versa. Think of the Sun, Moon, Mars, and Earth before and after Copernicus. Of free fall, pendular, and planetary motion before and after Galileo. Or of salts, alloys, and a sulfur-iron filing mix before and after Dalton. Since most objects within even the altered sets continue to be grouped together, the names of the sets are usually preserved. Nevertheless, the transfer of a subset is ordinarily part of a critical change in the network of interrelations among them. Transferring the metals from the set of compounds to the set of elements played an essential role in the emergence of a new theory of combustion, of acidity, and of physical and chemical combination. In short order, those changes had spread through all of chemistry. Not surprisingly, therefore, when such redistributions occur, two men whose discourse had previously proceeded with apparently full understanding may suddenly find themselves responding to the same stimulus with incompatible descriptions and generalizations. Those difficulties will not be felt in all areas of even their scientific discourse, but they will arise, and will then cluster most densely about the phenomena upon which the choice of theory most centrally depends. Such problems, though they first become evident in communication, are not merely linguistic, and they cannot be resolved simply by stipulating the definitions of troublesome terms. Because the words about which difficulties cluster have been learned in part from direct application to exemplars, the participants in a communication breakdown cannot say, "I use the word element, or mixture, or planet, or unconstrained motion, in ways determined by the following criteria." They cannot, that is, resort to a neutral language, which both use in the same way, and which is adequate to the statement of both their theories, or even of both those theories' empirical consequences. Part of the difference is prior to the application of the languages in which it is nevertheless reflected. The men who experience such communication breakdowns must, however, have some recourse. The stimuli that impinge upon them are the same. So is their general neural apparatus, however differently programmed. Furthermore, except in a small, if all-important, area of experience, even their neural programming must be very nearly the same, for they share a history, except the immediate past. As a result, both their everyday and most of their scientific world and language are shared. Given that much in common, they should be able to find out a great deal about how they differ. The techniques required are not, however, either straightforward or comfortable, or parts of the scientist's normal arsenal. Scientists rarely recognize them for quite what they are, and they seldom use them for longer than is required to induce conversion, or convince themselves that it will not be obtained. Briefly put, what the participants in a communication breakdown can do is recognize each other as members of different language communities, and then become translators. Taking the differences between their own intra- and intergroup discourse as itself a subject for study, they can first attempt to discover the terms and locutions that, used unproblematically within each community, are nevertheless foci of trouble for intergroup discussions. Locutions that present no such difficulties may be homophonically translated. Having isolated such areas of difficulty in scientific communication, they can next resort to their shared, everyday vocabularies in an effort further to elucidate their troubles. Each may, that is, try to discover what the other would see and say when presented with a stimulus to which his own verbal response would be different. If they can sufficiently refrain from explaining anomalous behavior as the consequence of mere error or madness, they may in time become very good predictors of each other's behavior. Each will have learned to translate the other's theory and its consequences into his own language, and simultaneously to describe in his language the world to which that theory applies. That is what the historian of science regularly does, or should, when dealing with out-of-date scientific theories. Since translation, if pursued, allows the participants in a communication breakdown to experience vicariously something of the merits and defects of each other's points of view, it is a potent tool, both for persuasion and for conversion. But even persuasion need not succeed, and if it does, it need not be accompanied or followed by conversion. The two experiences are not the same, an important distinction that I have only recently fully recognized. To persuade someone is, I take it, to convince him that one's own view is superior, and ought therefore supplant his own. That much is occasionally achieved without recourse to anything like translation. In its absence, many of the explanations and problem statements endorsed by the members of one scientific group will be opaque to the other. But each language community can usually produce, from the start, a few concrete research results that, though describable in sentences understood in the same way by both groups, cannot yet be accounted for by the other community in its own terms. If the new viewpoint endures for a time and continues to be fruitful, the research results verbalizable in this way are likely to grow in number. For some men, such results alone will be decisive. They can say, "I don't know how the proponents of the new view succeed, but I must learn. Whatever they are doing, it is clearly right." That reaction comes particularly easily to men just entering the profession, for they have not yet acquired the special vocabularies and commitments of either group. Arguments statable in the vocabulary that both groups use in the same way are not, however, usually decisive, at least not until a very late stage in the evolution of the opposing views. Among those already admitted to the profession, few will be persuaded without some recourse to the more extended comparisons permitted by translation. Though the price is often sentences of great length and complexity, think of the Proust-Berthollet controversy conducted without recourse to the term element. Many additional research results can be translated from one community's language into the other's. As translation proceeds, furthermore, some members of each community may also begin vicariously to understand how a statement, previously opaque, could seem an explanation to members of the opposing group. The availability of techniques like these does not, of course, guarantee persuasion. For most people, translation is a threatening process, and it is entirely foreign to normal science. Counterarguments are, in any case, always available, and no rules prescribe how the balance must be struck. Nevertheless, as argument piles on argument, and as challenge after challenge is successfully met, only blind stubbornness can at the end account for continued resistance. That being the case, a second aspect of translation, long familiar to both historians and linguists, becomes crucially important. To translate a theory or worldview into one's own language is not to make it one's own. For that, one must go native, discover that one is thinking and working in, not simply translating out of, a language that was previously foreign. That transition is not, however, one that an individual may make or refrain from making by deliberation and choice, however good his reasons for wishing to do so. Instead, at some point in the process of learning to translate, he finds that the transition has occurred, that he has slipped into the new language without a decision having been made. Or else, like many of those who first encountered, say, relativity or quantum mechanics in their middle years, he finds himself fully persuaded of the new view, but nevertheless unable to internalize it and be at home in the world it helps to shape. Intellectually, such a man has made his choice, but the conversion required, if it is to be effective, eludes him. He may use the new theory nonetheless, but he will do so as a foreigner, in a foreign environment, an alternative available to him only because there are natives already there. His work is parasitic on theirs, for he lacks the constellation of mental sets which future members of the community will acquire through education. The conversion experience that I have likened to a Gestalt switch remains, therefore, at the heart of the revolutionary process. Good reasons for choice provide motives for conversion, and a climate in which it is more likely to occur. Translation may, in addition, provide points of entry for the neural reprogramming that, however inscrutable at this time, must underlie conversion. But neither good reasons nor translation constitute conversion, and it is that process we must explicate in order to understand an essential sort of scientific change. 6. Revolutions and Relativism. One consequence of the position just outlined has particularly bothered a number of my critics. They find my viewpoint relativistic, particularly as it developed in the last section of this book. My remarks about translation highlight the reasons for the charge. The proponents of different theories are like the members of different language culture communities. Recognizing the parallelism suggests that, in some sense, both groups may be right. Applied to culture and its development, that position is relativistic. But applied to science, it may not be, and it is in any case far from mere relativism, in a respect that its critics have failed to see. Taken as a group, or in groups, practitioners of the developed sciences are, I have argued, fundamentally puzzle solvers. Though the values that they deploy at times of theory choice derive from other aspects of their work as well, the demonstrated ability to set up and to solve puzzles presented by nature is, in case of value conflict, the dominant criterion for most members of a scientific group. Like any other value, puzzle-solving ability proves equivocal in application. Two men who share it may nevertheless differ in the judgments they draw from its use. But the behavior of a community which makes it preeminent will be very different from that of one which does not. In the sciences, I believe, the high value accorded to puzzle-solving ability has the following consequences. Imagine an evolutionary tree representing the development of the modern scientific specialties from their common origins in, say, primitive natural philosophy and the crafts. A line drawn up that tree, never doubling back, from the trunk to the tip of some branch, would trace a succession of theories related by descent. Considering any two such theories, chosen from points not too near their origin, it should be easy to design a list of criteria that would enable an uncommitted observer to distinguish the earlier from the more recent theory, time after time. Among the most useful would be accuracy of prediction, particularly of quantitative prediction, the balance between esoteric and everyday subject matter, and the number of different problems solved. Less useful for this purpose, though also important determinants of scientific life, would be such values as simplicity, scope, and compatibility with other specialties. Those lists are not yet the ones required, but I have no doubt that they can be completed. If they can, then scientific development is, like biological, a unidirectional and irreversible process. Later scientific theories are better than earlier ones for solving puzzles, in the often quite different environments to which they are applied. That is not a relativist's position, and it displays the sense in which I am a convinced believer in scientific progress. Compared with the notion of progress most prevalent among both philosophers of science and laymen, however, this position lacks an essential element. A scientific theory is usually felt to be better than its predecessors, not only in the sense that it is a better instrument for discovering and solving puzzles, but also because it is somehow a better representation of what nature is really like. One often hears that successive theories grow ever closer to, or approximate more and more closely to, the truth. Apparently, generalizations like that refer not to the puzzle solutions and the concrete predictions derived from a theory, but rather to its ontology, to the match, that is, between the entities with which the theory populates nature and what is really there. Perhaps there is some other way of salvaging the notion of truth for application to whole theories, but this one will not do. There is, I think, no theory-independent way to reconstruct phrases like really there. The notion of a match between the ontology of a theory and its real counterpart in nature now seems to me elusive in principle. Besides, as a historian, I am impressed with the implausibility of the view. I do not doubt, for example, that Newton's mechanics improves on Aristotle's and that Einstein's improves on Newton's as instruments for puzzle solving. But I can see, in their succession, no coherent direction of ontological development. On the contrary, in some important respects, though by no means in all, Einstein's general theory of relativity is closer to Aristotle's than either of them is to Newton's. Though the temptation to describe that position as relativistic is understandable, the description seems to me wrong. Conversely, if the position be relativism, I cannot see that the relativist loses anything needed to account for the nature and development of the sciences. 7. The nature of science. I conclude with a brief discussion of two recurrent reactions to my original text. The first critical, the second favorable, and neither, I think, quite right. Though the two relate neither to what has been said so far nor to each other, both have been sufficiently prevalent to demand at least some response. A few readers of my original text have noticed that I repeatedly pass back and forth between the descriptive and the normative modes, a transition particularly marked in occasional passages that open with, "But that is not what scientists do," and close by claiming that scientists ought not do so. Some critics claim that I am confusing description with prescription, violating the time-honored philosophical theorem, "Is cannot imply ought." That theorem has, in practice, become a tag, and it is no longer everywhere honored. A number of contemporary philosophers have discovered important contexts in which the normative and the descriptive are inextricably mixed. Is and ought are by no means always so separate as they have seemed. But no recourse to the subtleties of contemporary linguistic philosophy is needed to unravel what has seemed confused about this aspect of my position. The preceding pages present a viewpoint or theory about the nature of science. And like other philosophies of science, the theory has consequences for the way in which scientists should behave if their enterprise is to succeed. Though it need not be right, any more than any other theory, it provides a legitimate basis for reiterated oughts and shoulds. Conversely, one set of reasons for taking the theory seriously is that scientists, whose methods have been developed and selected for their success, do in fact behave as the theory says they should.